This is Radio Boston. I'm Chris Sidorick. And that's the sound of hundreds of protesters peacefully marching in Boston yesterday, calling for justice for Breonna Taylor, after a Kentucky grand jury decided not to bring charges for killing Taylor against the police officers who shot her. And it wasn't just Boston. Protests and marches took place in Sacramento, Colorado Springs, Minneapolis, Nashville, and many other cities around the nation. An outpouring of emotion, anger, sadness, frustration over police violence in America. Writing today on WBUR's Ideas and Opinions page, Cognoscenti, former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick says, quote, "Enough. Policing in America has to change for peace in America to exist." And he joins us now. Governor Patrick, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Chris, thank you. I wish the circumstances were different.
Yeah, that's putting it mildly. I'm going to start with a question, Governor, that we've asked many of our guests in the last 6 months. 2020 has thrown a lot at us.
Ooh-wee.
Yeah. How are you doing?
Thank you for asking, Chris. I am, in 2020 terms, I'm fine. You know, my family is safe and healthy, and we are mostly together, and we're for the first couple months. We are able to put food on the table, and we have still things we can laugh about. But we're also very mindful and heartsick about the fact that is none of that, and much of that is not true for an awful lot of our friends and neighbors around the Commonwealth, around the country.
Yeah. The piece you wrote on Cognoscenti, you'll get to a couple specific things from that in a moment, but I'm wondering if you could take us back to last week when you heard the news out of the grand jury. What did you think? How did you react?
Well, you know, as a lawyer and having listened to some of the analysis, I wasn't entirely surprised, but I will tell you that setting aside my legal training, I wanted the outcome to be different, but I expected this to be the outcome. I know it is true that prosecutors have a tremendous amount of discretion over how to present charges to grand juries and whether to you know, and their ability to persuade grand juries of to charge. To charge police. You know, police are an important part of the society. Police unions are an important political feature. And there's a certain amount of our political rhetoric, Chris, that makes it seem as if the price we pay for safety is a tremendous amount of latitude given to police. But it's that sort of equation that I think a lot of us feel and have felt for a long time we've got to rethink.
Yeah, I do need to acknowledge, obviously, one of the challenges of 2020 is we're all doing this remotely, having a little bit of trouble with your line there, but we get some folks trying.
Sorry.
That's okay. It happens. It's our reality these days. I want to refer to a specific line in your piece, if that's all right. You write, quote, "I try my best to make people comfortable before plowing into hard subjects, but when it comes to the violence in black people's lives, especially when it involves the police, I'm so tired of white people being comfortable, or is it complacent?" Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, look, I think it was important to acknowledge that this is a change in tone in some respects. It's an impatience that I feel, but I don't often express. And I do think that I have worked really hard in my public and private life to try to be understanding of different and competing points of view. And I know that when it comes to race, an awful lot of the work is making white people comfortable with the subject before you can get into it. But, you know, I've been thinking a lot about just take the protests that have been happening since George Floyd was killed. The outrage was nearly universal. It was unavoidable to be able to witness something like that and not be affected. And there was and there have been alongside those protests you know, large numbers of people, varied backgrounds of the people who turned out in various cities and communities around the country. And there have been hooligans. I hate violence. I hate it in all forms. There was an analysis just the other day by Huffington Post that 93%, this is an analysis of all of the incidents of reported violence in all of the protests, 93% of the protests have been peaceful. But the focus that you see in the media on the violence, as if that disqualifies or delegitimates the gravity of the demand that we have justice and a different way to think about safety and peace in communities, is so enormously frustrating. And I think that's what I'm trying to get at. We have to get past, we have to learn to separate, you know, hooliganism from the legitimate anguish that people are expressing and the absolute need for change.
Yeah, I think that's why it struck me, is it was such a different tone for you. I think you're kind of known as a consensus builder. I'm thinking back to when you jumped in the presidential race. Your main message was, we need to find ways to love and understand each other. Was it difficult to show a different side, or can you talk a little bit about that decision to take that tone?
Well, I wish it wasn't viewed as such a different tone. You know, one of the things I talked about in my race and that I believe is that we have to get past this notion of false choices. You know, I talked about and still believe I'm a dedicated and proud Democrat, but I don't think you have to hate Republicans to be a good Democrat. I don't think you have to hate business to be a social justice warrior. And in the same vein, I don't think you have to hate police to believe Black Lives Matter. And I think we're going to have to get past the rhetorical boxes we put ourselves in. The lives of Black people count. That does not mean that the lives and the value of police or of anybody else don't count. But what we've been doing, it seems to me, is reaching a whole host of decisions that treat the lives of everybody else as important, and the lives of Black people, particularly in interactions with the police, as less. And that those accumulated decisions and actions are things we have to confront. They are points of evidence in how we have to reform the systems that we have. And it's, by the way, Chris, it's within our power to do this. We're not dealing with any problem that we as a society haven't made. And so these problems ought to be within our capacity to care about and to solve.
Do you worry at all? You mentioned kind of the reaction, the overwhelming reaction in the immediate aftermath of George Floyd's killing and that video coming out. Do you worry at all about losing momentum to this cause? You know, I saw a Pew Research study from earlier this month that said support for Black Lives Matter is down from where it was just last June. In June, 67% of the country expressed some level of support for the movement. That's now down to 55%. I'm wondering if we risk losing a moment when there's real systemic change possible.
Well, I think there's always that risk. I think there's always been that risk, and I think that's one of the reasons why we haven't had systemic change, or at least sustained change. That is not to say we haven't made progress, much of it in my lifetime, in race relations and in racial understanding, and in many of our systems. That is not what I'm saying, but I am saying that we've got to get to a place where we stop being so focused on the methods, and focus instead on the substance. The taking by pro athletes of a knee is a deeply peaceful, profound protest. But we spent a tremendous a lot of time under the president's leadership criticizing that form of peaceful protest. And there have been, as I said, marches in Boston and in cities all around the country that have also been overwhelmingly peaceful. But we focus in on the violence, and that takes us away. And again, I am not condoning the violence. I hate it. I reject it. And I have loved the fact that so many of the organizers of the peaceful protests have been the ones telling the hooligans to cut it out. But focusing on that at the expense of the deeper issue is a serious problem. I want to make sure that we don't make that mistake.
Yeah, to that point, to the substance aspect, I'm sure you know the police reform bill is at the State House, still in conference committee. I want to play a little bit of tape from last week, your successor, Governor Charlie Baker, talking about Taylor's case as an impetus for the state's police reform bill.
I really hope that at some point this fall, we have a chance to appropriately celebrate the signing of legislation that will hopefully deal with and solve some of these very important and significant public policy and public safety issues going forward.
So we've heard from some activists that are concerned that the longer this is taking, the more likely it is that the legislation could get watered down and be less meaningful. Are you optimistic that Massachusetts is going to meet this moment and pass meaningful reform?
I take nothing for granted. And given the urgency of the moment, given how temperatures flash around this issue, and given, frankly, the depth and expertise of many of the members of the legislature, I really don't understand why we don't have a bill. I appreciate that that the governor asked for action this fall instead of, you know, whenever it is the legislature decides to get around to it when they're back in regular session after the new year. And he has a lot of influence with legislative leadership. I hope he'll engage, and I hope he'll get folks to agreement. I know that there's some parts of this bill or the proposals I've read about that are not easy. You know, qualified immunity, for example, is among the hardest issues. I think there is a solution there, and I hope we get a compromise. And I hope the bill is meaningful and not just a, you know, another round of better training, and so, but really an opportunity, not that that isn't important, but an opportunity to think about so many of the, to think in fresh ways about so many of the things we ask police to do that, you know, intact communities used to be able to do, you know, dealing with mental health issues and substance abuse issues, dealing with truancy, and frankly, so many of the issues that surround poverty, and we've been starving our strategies for dealing with many of those issues, and it has fallen to the police. In many respects, it's also fallen to teachers, and so we have an opportunity to rethink so much of that in marvelous creative ways with the help and input of the communities themselves.
Yeah, you mentioned qualified immunity. That has been a major sticking point here. I'm wondering what you would say to, say, law enforcement officers who might be listening, thinking, you know, hey, I go out there every day. I put my life on the line to serve and to protect, and average citizens can't understand what it's like in the heat of the moment. What would you say to someone like that?
First of all, I honor their service, and I honor those who come to that service understanding that building a relationship with the community is a lot better for their own safety and for the safety of the community, which is why a tried and true idea of community policing where we have enough officers out of their cars, walking the streets and building relationships with people is a strategy that works. But it isn't just conventional policing we're talking about. It's about having other professionals with other competencies available to help with things that really aren't about policing. They aren't about maintaining order or crime solving. And I mentioned some of them already. And in terms of qualified immunity, look, I may not be as far along that spectrum as some of the advocates. I think there is a place for qualified immunity, but I think what we have in the name of qualified immunity is absolute immunity. And I think that the limitations on information about the habits of police officers who don't abide by the rule, the lack of rules, the lack of transparency, the way the you know, so-called blue wall falls down and protects everyone. You know, I've talked in the past about a case I had where I litigated I was the lawyer for a medical student who was roughed up by the police, and the police came to trial and testified that they had independently written in their own hand an account of what happened, And it was a complete coincidence that those two statements were word for word, commas and periods the same, misspellings the same. And we're supposed to accept that behavior. That is the sort of thing that has to change. And if we build a relationship with policing that is comprehensive, it isn't just about policing, it isn't just about the men and women in uniform, but about how communities are rebuilt and knit together, and the various services, public and private, that enable that, then I think much more transparency when the police step out of line is frankly even easier for the police.
Governor Patrick, we're going to link your piece on our website, but I just want to ask you before I let you go, if folks who are listening are walking away from this conversation with one thing, what do you want that to be?
Hope. I hope that folks won't give up. I hope that the folks in the streets, from whatever community they come from, won't give up, won't let up on the pressure. I hope the folks who can't be in the streets but deeply care about rebuilding bridges between each other and learning again to take a chance on our neighbors, that we have a stake in them and they in us, won't give up. And I hope that the folks on the on police forces all across the Commonwealth and other and elsewhere, who know that there's a better way, won't give up. We could get to a better place. We're going to have to get there together and get there soon.
Deval Patrick's former governor of Massachusetts. You can find a link to his WBUR Cognoscenti piece at our website, radioboston.org. Governor Patrick, thanks so much for your time.
Chris, thanks for having me. Take care.